You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon in the 21st Century Defense Initiative. Delighted to be moderating this discussion today with my esteemed colleagues and good friends, Dan Byman and Bruce Riedel, both affiliated with our Saban Center, and Dan also at Georgetown. I will say a brief word in a moment about each of their respective latest outstanding books relevant to this topic before they will each open up with some comments, and then we will go to a bit of a discussion here and then over to you. Before I advertise their books and just say a quick additional word about each, I'd like to say something that I'm sure all of you would want to join in expressing sentimentally and otherwise, which is a word of admiration and thanks for all of our forces abroad, our diplomats, others who were involved in the effort to find and target Osama bin Laden, but also to try to build in a more positive way on all the efforts that we're trying to engage in with our partners abroad. So whether it's the Navy SEALs who conducted the raid, all of our other military personnel who were involved in supporting it, or in other operations around the world, our amazing intelligence personnel who found bin Laden against all the odds and after many, many years of difficult work, and of course all of our partners abroad, Pakistani friends who often get a bad name in this discussion, and perhaps in this particular case we still have some disagreements and some angst, but of course over the years, whether with finding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or other targets, were important and helpful. Afghan friends who have been involved and who, of course, provided us the bases in many ways that were needed for the operations, and other partners as well. I'm sure we all want to take this moment to express our admiration, our thanks for their service, and for those who have not made it home, for their families and their memories as well. Now, if I could just briefly mention, and I think most of you here know a good deal about Dan and Bruce and their work already, but I would like to remind you that Dan put forth a seminal book on Israeli counterterrorism, really a history of Israeli counterterrorism, as well as some of the most important lessons learned, called A High Price. I recommend this to anyone. It's a high price in the title, but not a high price at the bookstore, and we encourage you to read it. Also, page for page and idea for idea, it's an extremely good buy, even more than the average book. Bruce Riedel is known for conciseness and brevity and powerful ideas himself. And let me hold up, therefore, two of his books. The latest is Deadly Embrace, about the U.S.-Pakistan relationship in the context of global counterterrorism. And the previous book is The Search for Al-Qaeda, which, of course, is the most immediately relevant to today's topic. So without further ado, I will turn to Bruce, who will speak for about 10 minutes, and then Dan, and then we'll engage and then go to you.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thanks for that very kind introduction. And I just want to underscore the admiration, the gratitude that we all have towards the Navy SEALs and the CIA analysts and operators who found high-value target number one just about a year ago. What I'd like to do is look very briefly at three aspects of the situation. What was the impact of Osama bin Laden's killing on al-Qaeda core, the central nervous apparatus of the al-Qaeda movement? What was the impact on Pakistan itself, where he was, of course, killed? And finally, what was the impact on the U.S.-Pakistani relationship? So let's start with al-Qaeda core, or as it is called in Arabic, al-Qaeda al-Umm, or Mother al-Qaeda. I'll sum it up simply. Devastating, but not fatal, at least yet. The Osama bin Laden that was brought to justice a year ago was not hiding in a cave. He was not a recluse. He was the CEO of a global terrorist organization, the first in world history. He was receiving communications from al-Qaeda operatives literally around the world, and he was instructing them to carry out acts of terror. Now, not every instruction he gave was followed, and some of them were quite fanciful. But I suspect that almost every CEO of every major corporation in the world would say, not all of my instructions are carried out either when I go to an organization. He had been in that facility for 6 years, which is a remarkable amount of time for one person to stay in one place and not be found. And literally a library of material was found with him. The SEALs brought out what has been referred to as the functional equivalent of a small liberal arts college library which has been now successfully translated and largely studied completely. Of course, in the wake of this devastating attack on Al-Qaeda, which eliminated the CEO, which eliminated this hideout, which acquired all this intelligence, there was a series of follow-on drone strikes which killed some of Al-Qaeda's most important operatives. I'll just give you one. Mohammed Ilyas Kashmiri, a man heavily involved in the Mumbai 2008 plot and the subsequent Copenhagen plot, and the man that Osama bin Laden had tasked to come up with a plot to assassinate President Obama. I can't tell you that there's a direct correlation between the raid in Abbottabad and the killing of Mohammed Ilyas Kashmiri, but I think there's pretty good reason to suspect that there was. In short, the Abbottabad raid fulfilled Obama's March 2009 commitment that American policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan would be designed to disrupt, dismantle, and ultimately defeat Al-Qaeda. But the ultimate defeat, I don't think, has occurred. Al-Qaeda for a long time had anticipated, like any good organization, that sooner or later their boss might be put out of action and had a well-planned and well-prepared succession process ready to go into effect, and we saw it rolled out pretty efficiently in the weeks right after the death of Osama bin Laden. And his deputy and heir apparent, Ayman Zawahiri, moved quickly into fulfilling the role of emir of Al-Qaeda, not only Al-Qaeda al-Umm, but Al-Qaeda global with all of the franchises. Zawahiri cannot hope to fill Osama bin Laden's larger-than-life footprint. Osama bin Laden was an incredible story, the son of a Saudi multi-billionaire who went off to war in Afghanistan and then masterminded the largest terrorist attack in human history. But Zawahiri should not be underestimated. This is a man who's been involved in terror since 1981. He was a participant in the plot that assassinated Anwar Sadat. He was key to the plot that led to the death of seven CIA officers in Khost in Afghanistan in late 2009. He was probably the mastermind of the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. This is an experienced terrorist who knows his business. Don't expect him to be a carbon copy of Osama bin Laden, but don't underestimate him. Now he's in the phase, I think, of trying to rebuild Al-Qaeda core, while at the same time trying to project an image that the revolutions in the Arab world are ultimately going to benefit Al-Qaeda. Dan's going to talk about that more, but we're seeing a fairly heavy propaganda flow from Ayman Zawahiri, about one new video message a month. What about Pakistan? The impact on Pakistan I would describe as disruptive, but not a strategic game changer. In the immediate aftermath of the raid, Pakistan was in angst for a number of reasons. First of all, the United States had demonstrated that it could penetrate into the heart of Pakistan's national security establishment within a mile of the Pakistani West Point, come in and out before Pakistani air defenses had any idea what was going on. It immediately raised the $64 million question for every Pakistani, if the Americans can do it, can the Indians do it? It damaged the prestige of the Pakistani military. But in the end, it didn't lead to, I think, fundamental changes in the way Pakistan thinks about the world. A mini crisis developed with the title of Memogate. For those of you who don't remember, this was alleged that a memo had been written to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff asking for assistance in preventing a military coup in Pakistan. Only in Pakistan could assistance in preventing a military coup be regarded as treason, but in this case it was. Ambassador Haqqani was accused of being the author of that. He lost his job, and for a time there it looked like he might lose his life. But then through the miracle of YouTube, the Memogate crisis went away when a video appeared of the main accuser acting as the MC in a nude mud wrestling contest in Belgium. I couldn't make that up. It's the truth.
You really couldn't.
In short, the accuser went from being regarded as a pious nationalist patriot to being what I think President Obama would call a Secret Service knucklehead. His credibility was lost, and the crisis went away. Pakistan is now in the midst of a new crisis over the Supreme Court finding the Prime Minister guilty of contempt of court. The important point about Pakistan, though, is that I don't think any of this crisis atmosphere led to any introspection on the part of the Pakistani establishment and the Pakistani leadership. Why had Osama bin Laden been able to hide within a mile of the Kabul Military Academy for 6 years does not seem to be a question that has really been resounding or resonating inside Pakistan. It's a question that should resonate. It should make Pakistanis think about what's going on in their country, but it simply has not been seriously addressed. As a consequence, I don't think we've seen any fundamental shift in Pakistan's policy of playing both sides in the war on terror. And I think that that was dramatically demonstrated just a week or two ago when the United States put a bounty on the head of Lashkar-e-Taiba, Hafez Saeed, and the Pakistani media and the Pakistani establishment more or less brushed it off as a joke, because after all, everyone knew where Hafez Saeed was. Why do you need to have a bounty? The more important question that Pakistanis should have asked themselves is, why are three of the five most wanted on the Department of Justice most wanted list in Pakistan today? Ayman Zawahiri, Mullah Omar, and Hafez Saeed. That leads us to the U.S.-Pakistani relationship, and here I would say the impact was devastating, and it may possibly be a game-changer for U.S.-Pakistan relations. First of all, it wasn't just this raid. 2011 was supposed to be the year that President Obama went to Pakistan. Instead, it's the year the U.S.-Pakistani relationship fell apart. First, there was the Ray Davis affair, the CIA officer who killed two Pakistanis. Then there was the Abbottabad raid. Then there was the attack on Pakistani soldiers by NATO gunships on the border in November. And throughout, there was the steady drip, drip, drip of drone operations. Pakistanis became increasingly angered by American foreign policy. Abbottabad, I think, crystallized all of that. For Pakistanis, the United States increasingly appears to be an arrogant superpower which has decided to turn their country into a killing field where it can kill anyone it wants. For Americans, of course, Pakistan is a deceitful, double-dealing country that's on both sides of the war on terror, takes our money, and then harbors major terrorists who kill Americans. Hafez Saeed killed six Americans in Mumbai in November 2008. The problem for this relationship is that both sides basically have it right. And it's pretty hard to rebuild a relationship when it's got to that point. It was all really crystallized in the president's decision to send in the SEALs. One of the most important decisions the president made, not last May, but last March, was not to tell Pakistan that we knew where Osama bin Laden was, or we thought we knew where he was. When you think about it, it was an extraordinary decision. He and his predecessor, George Bush, have provided Pakistan with $25 billion, $25 billion in economic and military aid since September 11, 2001, to fight the war on al-Qaeda. And at the moment of truth, the President of the United States rightly decided we couldn't trust Pakistan with the most important information we had. We're now in a reset in U.S.-Pakistani relations. A dialogue is starting to resume. The Pakistani finance minister was here last week. Some of you I know came to his event here. Mark Grossman, the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, is in Islamabad today. And we're trying to see if, with reduced expectations and very modest hopes, a dialogue can begin again. But it looks to be pretty hard. The basis of the dialogue is going to be, on the Pakistani side, a report from Parliament that demands the cessation of all drone strikes. And the Pakistani foreign minister today reiterated that that has to be the basis. It's hard to see, then, how U.S. and Pakistan are going to get this relationship back on the road. The United States is not going to abandon unilateral measures to go after high-value targets in Pakistan, and those unilateral measures are going to continue to arouse popular unhappiness. Sooner or later, there will be another drone strike, and we'll see what Pakistan's reaction is. And sooner or later, the CIA is going to find Ayman Zawahiri. And I have no doubt that if it happens on President Obama's watch, he'll send the SEALs in again. On top of that, of course, we're fighting a proxy war in Afghanistan. We support the Karzai government. They support the Afghan Taliban. One implication of all of this is that importance of Afghanistan as a long-term strategic base for the United States to carry out unilateral operations has been underscored in the last year. And I don't think it's any accident that we've just signed this long-term strategic relationship with Afghanistan. The administration recognizes that if those helicopters had to come out of the Arabian Sea, that mission would have failed and failed disastrously. They need a base nearby. Last point, there is a way out of this. There is a way that I think U.S.-Pakistani relations can get back on track, and that would be if Pakistan would push the Afghan Taliban into a political process with the Karzai government. It's not a be-all and end-all, but it would certainly help to change the atmosphere, not just between Pakistan and Afghanistan, but I think more broadly throughout South Asia. The choice now really is up to the Pakistanis. They have tremendous leverage over the Afghan Taliban. I don't say they can deliver them, but they can certainly encourage them to come to a political process. And that, to me, would be the best way to move out of the cul-de-sac that U.S.-Pakistani relations have gotten themselves into.
Thank you, Bruce. Dan, over to you, sir.
I wanted to focus my remarks this afternoon on what I feel are two big uncertainties about the status of al-Qaeda and where things might go. The first is the question of affiliate groups, and the second is al-Qaeda and the Arab Spring. Really, how you see the affiliate groups, al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, al-Qaeda of Iraq, the Shabab, in many ways, to me, determines how dangerous you'll see the threat. Because if the mother al-Qaeda, as Bruce calls it, is a couple hundred people, and it's certainly shown it's capable, it's lethal, but its real army, if you will, are these affiliate groups. And whether they're close or whether they're far away, to me, determines how dangerous the core group itself is and how dangerous the overall threat of terrorism is. We've seen a real shift in the last decade, since 9/11. Before 9/11, al-Qaeda always wanted to try to bring together different groups to fight together, to work together in a kind of a more generic trying to help all boats, but also at the same time to try to unify the broader jihadist community. And when it worked with these jihad group in Egypt, Zawahiri's original organization, that was an important first step where parts of this organization joined up with al-Qaeda, you know, starting throughout the 1990s and formally before the 9/11 attacks. But we've seen in the last decade, really, this has gone on steroids, where a number of groups around the globe have taken on the al-Qaeda label. And this trend actually seems to be accelerating, where very recently we've seen the Shabab. In Nigeria, we see Boko Haram moving in a very dangerous direction. And so we see groups that primarily had a local agenda, a local focus, local fighters, having somewhat of an al-Qaeda flavor to them. And that somewhat is really the key. On one hand, you have groups like al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula doing attacks that could be out of the al-Qaeda core's playbook, attacks on commercial civil aviation and the United States. In other cases, you have attacks on Western targets, international targets, but they are really local. They might be in in West Africa, they might be in the Maghreb. So you're seeing some local, some global. So there's a real range. But we are seeing a pronounced shift when you take a big picture look. The primary threat these groups currently pose is actually to U.S. allies. There is a danger to U.S. personnel. There is a danger even to some degree to the U.S. homeland. But really, when you think about broader U.S. interests in the region, you think about the stability of Saudi Arabia, of Algeria, or even places like Egypt, where these groups have the ability to mix things up, not necessarily dominate, but the ability to have an influence on events on the ground. But also, and very worrisome, is a number of these groups, because they're local in origin, have the ability to tap into diaspora populations around the world. So in the United Kingdom, of course, and Bruce can talk more definitively than I, you see a number of groups in Pakistan involved in the Pakistani diaspora in the United Kingdom. You have Yemenis, you have Somalis around the world, and that can be in the United States and that can be elsewhere, but it's a more intimate tie. It's one that involves communities at home as well as individuals who have joined this more global brand. The last thing I'll say on the affiliate question is that there's actually a tension, if you look historically, between the United States and its allies, in that often what has led some groups, not all groups, to affiliate is actually they start to fail locally. So we see in Egypt in the 1990s, we see in Algeria, we see groups that really tried to run an insurgency locally, and they lost. And so the question is what to do next. And some of these groups keep fighting. Some of these groups give up arms. And some go global because it's a way of staying active, because they're ideologically committed. And so what we've seen from most of the affiliates is actually a splintering, where some of the parts of the affiliate organization have really kept doing what they've always been doing. But the result in some ways is as or if local allies start to do better against terrorist groups in their country, we may actually see some of those groups embracing a global agenda. Or I should say more accurately, some parts of some of those groups. It's very hard to talk about groups and more appropriate to talk about factions within them. And as a result, the United States and its allies have an interest in fighting terrorism. But there's always a question of who's on the top of the group's priority list. And to me, this is really some space to watch. And this tension is, of course, I think even more so now that the entire Middle East is being transformed through the Arab Spring. We had a good news story, and I helped tell it, probably not that well, about the Arab Spring. And that was that the Arab Spring brings in a new narrative that discredits al-Qaeda. It talks about the importance of peaceful activism, of youth. It shows that political change is possible without violence. And that it's not about the United States, so you don't need to focus your anger and your energy on America. You can focus locally and achieve change. And I think that's still true. But when you look at the Arab Spring, what we've seen is change has happened in order of optimism, right? So Tunisia went first, and you know, I feel pretty good about Tunisia. Egypt, second, kind of mixed, right? There's certainly good news, but there's also a lot of things to worry about. Then when you start to look at Libya, you start to look at Yemen, at least I get much more worried. And then, of course, you look at Syria, and it's frightening. And so the question of whether the Arab Spring is actually a good news story, the question of whether it's a story that involves peaceful change rather than violent change, this has yet to be written, or at least definitively answered. And I think we're likely to see some variation, where some peaceful successes and some violent failures. And so when you look through the region, you still see a number of negative things for counterterrorism. It's popular to talk about how al-Qaeda, bin Laden, that motto has been discredited. And certainly when you compare the popularity of these groups to the height of the Iraq War, you see dramatic changes. But you still see in Indonesia and the Palestinian territories and other places that, you know, in some places a quarter of the population has a relatively favorable opinion of al-Qaeda. And that's not a majority. But that's actually a staggering number of people. This is data taken from Pew. It's about 50% in Nigeria. And to me, that doesn't mean that these are all al-Qaeda operatives in waiting. But it does show that the narrative that al-Qaeda pushed is not discredited, or at least not completely discredited. Operationally, you see a shift as well. Part of this comes from the release of cadre from prison. In Egypt and other places, you had either mass prison escapes or prison releases upon the revolution. And many, perhaps most, probably most, of these individuals will not return to violence. But some will. And what a number of these groups lack is experienced cadre. And so when you add a relatively small number of committed, disciplined, proven people, that increases their capabilities. And add to that, you're going to see governments less able to stop them. In some places, governments simply will not be able to because of democratic reform. To me, if reform has any meaning, it means that you are purging security services because they are the point of the undemocratic spear. They are the ones who go after democratic dissent. But if you purge the security services, you're purging the people who go after terrorists. You're purging the ones who cooperate with America against these groups. And it's easy to say preserve one without the other. But in practice, it's exceptionally difficult. And even in countries where we haven't seen change, let's say Jordan, for example, or Algeria, the priority of the security services is going to be to go after the biggest threat to the regime, which is democratic dissent. It's not terrorism. And that doesn't mean they'll abandon counterterrorism, but there will be a shift in priorities that, from a counterterrorism point of view, is really going to matter. The last thing I'll say on this is really about civil wars, which is, in Syria in particular, we have a real danger. And right now, the opposition in Syria, so far it's still, amazingly, mostly peaceful. And what is violent is actually, to me, with a very small number of exceptions, not at all in a serious way linked to the jihadist movement. We get regular reports of individuals, but if you look at them in aggregate, you're talking very small numbers. That said, what al-Qaeda has done exceptionally successfully is taking advantage of local struggles and made them mirrors of its own cause. So if you look at Chechnya, if you look at Somalia, if you look at Iraq, all these things were local nationalism, local concerns, and al-Qaeda came, worked with the community, posed as defenders against an aggressive regime, as against other communities, and in doing so insinuated itself, and over time was able to spread its message, was able to radicalize part of the broader resistance movement. And I'm not saying that that path will inevitably be followed in Syria. But it's, to me, a real possibility, as the situation in Syria right now, to me, seems to be a case where the government is too weak to win, but so is the opposition. So you have a period of prolonged civil war that I think terrorist groups can insert themselves. Let me close by pointing to what I feel is one of the biggest uncertainties that comes from the Arab Spring, which is the role of peaceful Islamist parties. The Islamist parties, like the Muslim Brotherhood, could be the greatest potential ally against radical groups. From a narrative point of view, they can say, we can bring about an Islamic State through gradual peaceful means, and we can do so without opposition from the United States. And that right there is a very strong counter to the radical message. Also, from an intelligence point of view, they know their own community. They know who the radicals are within the broader Islamist movement. And if that can be harnessed, that can be exceptionally effective. However, there's a lot of uncertainty here. We don't know the Brotherhood, what it's going to be like if, or perhaps I should say when it holds power. And in general, if it's blocked from achieving power, as it may be in some countries, then you have a question of whether bin Laden's message is actually vindicated, whether you're saying, no, actually, you can't achieve power, you can't achieve what you want through democratic means, you're going to be blocked. And so to me, this is a big question mark. From a counterterrorism point of view, which is my narrow focus today, there's potential, but there's also risk. So let me stop there, please. Thank you.
Excellent. Very rich presentations. And I'd like to speak just for a couple of minutes up here before we go to you with your questions to try to maybe ask Bruce and Dan to highlight a couple of points and tie it all together a little bit more, although they've already tied it together very nicely, because some of the themes that I'm hearing, we've heard Bruce talk about very successful operations against the al-Qaeda core and yet lingering worries about Zawahiri's potential and certainly a lot of ongoing problems with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship and the state of Pakistan in many other ways. We've heard Dan talk about the fact that Arab revolutions on balance are probably still hopeful if you had to say yes or no, one or the other, but obviously case by case, obviously country by country, and with a lot of potential for extremist groups and al-Qaeda to insert themselves and try to take advantage of these ongoing dynamics, not all of which are happy or pointing in the right direction. And we've also heard Dan talk about how global groups of one type and one stripe or another are often affiliating themselves, by name at least, by world outlook and ideology with al-Qaeda, and there's even been more of that perhaps in recent times than had been the trend previously. So how does it all add up? And that's really my first question for both of you. I'll start with Bruce, but it's the same question for both of you. If we just take a snapshot of world terrorism today compared to how it was exactly 365 years ago, just before the bin Laden raid, are we, if you want to put it this way, slightly better off or slightly worse off? That's the 365-day snapshot. But then if you could also situate 2012 within broader historical trends compared to where we were on September 10th, 2001, compared to where we were maybe 10 years before that, I would just love to get a little broader historical perspective on where we stand today. If I could begin with you, please, Bruce.
Sure. On the 365 days, there's no question we're better off. Al-Qaeda's core has been devastated by the loss of Osama bin Laden. He was the boss. He ran the organization. The archives he kept were the archives of the organization. It's a serious loss for them, no question about it. And in the long run, I think it does make us safer. It doesn't mean the war is over, but I think we are safer for it. I think another reason, Osama bin Laden, by a year ago, had achieved near mythic status. I hate to use the analogy, but I will. He was the Robin Hood of international terrorism. The sheriff couldn't find him, couldn't find any way to bring him to justice. I know this is distasteful to admirers of English history, so don't focus on the Robin Hood, focus on the idea. And that myth has been punctured. It's been destroyed. He was brought to justice. And there's every reason to believe that his successor will be brought to justice in the same way. That's an important accomplishment. Over the longer term, what worries me the most is that in Pakistan, it's not just Al-Qaeda. It's a syndicate of terrorists. It's Al-Qaeda, which is a relatively small group. It's a much larger sea of like-minded jihadists, Lashkar-e-Taiba being the most well-known in the United States. But there's a dozen organizations like Lashkar-e-Taiba which increasingly advocate the global jihad, which are tied in many ways to Al-Qaeda, and many of them, like Lashkar-e-Taiba, are also tied to the Pakistani intelligence service and the army. That syndicate is more powerful today than it was a decade ago. It holds mass demonstrations in Pakistani cities. There's one scheduled for tomorrow in Quetta in Baluchistan. And it's that syndicate of terrorism which is, to me, the most dangerous development in terms of the terrorist threat emanating out of South Asia.
Thank you. And Dan, if you could take whatever perspective you'd like on those questions.
I would certainly agree with Bruce that we are better off than we were a year ago from a counterterrorism point of view. What concerns me is that this is an organization that has demonstrated tremendous resilience. It's been around for almost 25 years now. And by the lifespan of terrorist groups, that's an incredibly long time. And we've seen it hit hard in several times in its history and bounce back. So let's start with 9/11. Shortly after 9/11, it is drummed out of Afghanistan. It is subject to a global manhunt that wrap up much of its cadre around the world. And you have complaints from within the broader Salafi jihadist community, so not moderate Islamists, not Muslim in general, saying, why on earth did we do 9/11? It was a disaster. And the organization was hit exceptionally hard. Then the organization managed to rebound, digging itself in Pakistan. The Iraq War was a tremendous boost to its narrative, to its prestige, and over time to its operations. Rises again. I would say since, I'll use 2006, but that's somewhat arbitrary. I would say since then, though, it hit pretty hard in a variety of ways. Reverses in Iraq and elsewhere, losing senior leadership, the expansion of the drone campaign, among other things. And the bin Laden death is part of that. But it's gone up and down, and it functions in multiple dimensions. It's a group, as I mentioned, that has ties to a range of affiliate organizations. It has a message that has risen and fallen in different parts of the world. And so we can think of it very narrowly as core Al-Qaeda. We can think of it as a broader set of organizations. We can think of it as a movement. And the answer to how well it's doing really depends on how you see all three of those.
Bruce, if I could follow up with one more question for you about South Asia groups. And you mentioned Lashkar-e-Taiba. And, of course, as you said, there are maybe a dozen others. Let me just put it in a nutshell, and not, you know, I realize you don't want to jinx anybody, but why haven't they attacked again since Mumbai? I mean, it's been 3 years. We see no evidence the Pakistanis are cracking down on them. At least I haven't heard you emphasize that point. We certainly haven't had any direct success against them within Pakistan itself. If they are so lethal, they are stronger than they were a decade ago, presumably unapologetic for what they've done, presumably still willing to take on the Kashmir agenda and any other kind of subject they think can rally Pakistanis to their side. Why have we been lucky enough not to see another strike for the last 3.5 years?
It's always pure speculation to answer questions. Why hasn't a terrorist attack occurred? A data point I would put out to you, we're pretty confident that a pretty big Lashkar-e-Taiba plot scheduled to take place in Dhaka, Bangladesh, was foiled by effective U.S., Indian, and Bangladeshi counterterrorism efforts in late 2009 and early 2010. So I would say they've been trying. They were foiled in that case. I think the other answer may be that the Pakistani intelligence service and the Pakistani army is practicing what is referred to as contain and corral, which is you don't actually crack down on the group, you don't prevent it from doing its thing, but you encourage its leadership, don't rock the boat right now. We don't want another crisis with India at this point. Get ready, practice, train, fundraise, but don't start an international incident at this time. If contain and corral is a Pakistani strategy that's being employed, and I think there's pretty solid evidence that it is, it's disturbing because it also suggests it's like a light switch. If they decide at some point, okay, it's time, you could see an operation very quickly after that.
Dan, if I could just ask you one more question specifically, and then we'll go to the crowd. And all other questions, of course, are fair game that have some linkage to the broader struggle against global terrorist movements, including the status of the war in Afghanistan, or anything else you want to bring up. But let me, if you don't mind, ask you specifically about Saudi Arabia, a country that hasn't come up in our discussion much so far, if at all, but clearly would be a worry if it did. And at one time, 8 or 9 years ago, was facing a serious internal Al-Qaeda-related threat and seems to have clamped down pretty well. It seems also not to be suffering any immediate threats of internal revolution of even more benign types. Whether that's good or bad can be debated, but I'd just like you to say a word, since that is such a pillar of our global economy and of our regional strategy. How would you size up the state of counterterrorism and more generally political stability in Saudi Arabia?
I'm glad you brought that up. This is, from a counterterrorism point of view, has been a real good news story in the last decade. The Saudis had a very serious terrorism problem that we all saw become manifest in 2003. And as I think everyone here knows, the Saudis were implicated as a nation, not necessarily as a government, in being responsible for a lot of the financing of terrorist activity of Al-Qaeda, that there are a fair number of wealthy Saudis who are very involved in this in a very nasty, negative way. Two big things to me. One is that the government, especially in 2003 when the threat to Saudi Arabia became obvious, very effectively went after this. And their intelligence services did quite well. They were also able to rally the Saudi people behind them. That Bruce mentioned the Robin Hood analogy. They were able to say, they're not Robin Hood, they're thugs, and they're thugs killing Muslims. And because the attacks in the kingdom were not just against Westerners, but were against ordinary Muslims, they were able to, this message was extremely effective. And it really discredited the radicals. And a number of them had to flee to Yemen. So you see much less of a problem in the kingdom. Another big success in Saudi Arabia was the mobilization of, I would say, the religious establishment, but I will say more broadly, a large number of religious figures, including many who had been critical of the Saudi regime, and mobilizing them to criticize violence and bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in particular. And this was done, this is an establishment that does not speak with one voice, but it went from having a number of individuals who were openly pro-Al-Qaeda to having the most senior and respected be quite critical of Al-Qaeda, and openly so. And that was a huge shift. It doesn't mean that Al-Qaeda disappears, but a lot of the legitimacy that it derives when it says it's Robin Hood is diminished when you have very respected people who say, no, you guys are a bunch of thugs. You're murderers. You're not achieving an Islamic state. You're making things worse for Muslims. You're going against what Islamic law teaches. And so to me, that was a tremendous success. And with all that, cooperation with the United States became much better. Now, there are still, anyone who's worked with the Saudi government knows there are tremendous capacity issues. And there is still sympathy for a variety of, I'll say, somewhat militant movements, including al-Qaeda in the kingdom. So this problem has not ended, gone away. It's still real. But we've seen a real shift in the last decade. The caveat, I will say, in terms of stability, is that while the price of oil is doing fine, so money is pouring into the kingdom's coffers, the Arab Spring has been effectively countered not only within Saudi Arabia, but within the Arabian Peninsula, with Saudi help. But their stability concern, to me, should be at least succession. In my view, at least from the outside, the Saudi succession system is incredibly opaque. This is a family that does stay together, that values consensus, so I don't expect dramatic splits. But that said, you have a number of leaders coming in who are less impressive, who are older and less dynamic, and to me there are going to be potential issues that come with that in the years to come.
Thank you. Okay, over to you. Please wait for a microphone after I've called on you. We'll start here, right just where you are, Adriana. Yes, thank you. And please identify yourself if you could, and have at us.
Robert Werner, the company is managing uncertainty. As everyone here knows, there is a lot of controversy about what will happen if there's a negotiated political settlement in Afghanistan. What is your opinion on two issues? Number one, do you think that al-Qaeda will return in force to Afghanistan? And secondly, do you think the imposition or establishment of the so-called Biden plan with special ops and drones could counteract that?
I'm in favor of a negotiated peace arrangement in Afghanistan. I think that is the long-term best approach to resolving the Afghan civil war. I'm a skeptic it's going to happen, but that's no reason to be against it. I think as part of any negotiated agreement, we would have to have very ironclad assurances from the Afghan Taliban that their relationship with al-Qaeda is over. And I don't mean rhetorical commitments. We would need to see practical intelligence sharing against al-Qaeda by elements of the Afghan Taliban. I think that's the bar that perhaps not in public, but in private, we would have to make clear to the Afghan Taliban is going to be the price of moving into a political process. I think, ironically, here, the death of Osama bin Laden helps us a lot. Osama bin Laden was a friend and ally of the Afghan Taliban. They eulogized him a year ago. They hailed him as a martyr of the Afghan movement. But he's gone now. He can remain a martyr of the Afghan movement. I don't care if he's in their history books as the good guy. I care about what they're doing today with Ayman Zawahiri and others. The Biden plan, I think, is where we're moving. I think I'll put it in shorthand. The Biden plan was wrong in 2009, and it will be right in 2015, and it will be right in 2015 because the president didn't act on it in 2009. And he enacted on a program of building up the Afghan army and waging a counterinsurgency against the Taliban to whittle them down to the stage where the Afghan army can deal with them, largely without foreign combat troops. At that point, the Afghanistan will continue to be important to the United States as a base not only for counter-terrorist operations in Afghanistan, but as I suggested earlier, in Pakistan as well.
Dan.
Let me very briefly add 2 points to what Bruce says. One on bin Laden's death and its impact. While Zawahiri was in Afghanistan and in Pakistan during the anti-Soviet period, he was focused on Egypt. And that was understood, that this is a man who's not here to help his brothers in the struggle against the Soviets, that this is a man who's here as a refuge to fight back in Egypt. So the sense of obligation, the sense of camaraderie from the old days is certainly less so. On the Biden plan, my conception of it is it's really about cost and risk. That, yes, of course, to me, the risk goes up when you are doing more of an approach that is lighter, that has more standoff, that has less ability to influence events on the ground. But the cost of a large-scale U.S. presence in Afghanistan is quite high. And so the question really, and this is really a national question, is are we prepared to embrace more risk at home, more risk to targets overseas? And that's a relative question. The next question is, well, how much more risk? And that's tough to evaluate. But to me, that's when I think of the Biden plan, and I think, I personally think we are ready, that the death of bin Laden and in general, the weakness of al-Qaeda in doing attacks on the United States in the last decade shows that we can accept more risk without the results inherently being catastrophic.
I'm just going to add one brief point myself, and then we'll go over to James Gitfield here in just a second. But one of the concerns that other people have raised about Afghanistan in terms of what kind of scenarios could wind up inviting an al-Qaeda presence ultimately into place would be, of course, some failure of the central government, followed by civil warfare, followed by the creation of large ungoverned spaces, namely potential sanctuaries. And some people have voiced the concern that ethnic tension or rivalry could lead to that outcome, where you essentially have a reincarnation of the Northern Alliance that winds up trying to hold on to the north and west of the country, whereas the Pashtun population, broadly defined, tries to hold on to the south. I think this risk is generally overrated because, first of all, most of the Pashtuns hate the Taliban. But nonetheless, if you wind up in a civil war scenario where you have main Tajik and some Pashtun leaders essentially reverting to a militia kind of combat, Pakistan may try to take advantage of that, make the Afghan Taliban the most powerful player in the south. And with Pakistani help, there is some worry that that could, in fact, at least create certain spaces where the Taliban did provide sanctuary for al-Qaeda. So to me, the number one antidote to this, apart from the ongoing patience with which President Obama is admirably drawing down our forces, is to think very hard about the Afghan political transition of the next couple of years. There's been an intriguing idea of the last few weeks that President Karzai himself has seemed to be willing to discuss in public, which is the possibility of accelerating the Afghan presidential election to next year so that some of that transition happens before we leave, or leave with our main combat forces. There are dangers, of course, in that kind of improvisation because it could mean that, you know, if it happens all very quickly, after the smoke settles and so forth, Karzai has handpicked his successor and nobody else has a chance to organize. That's the downside. But on balance, I think this is a good idea because I think it will encourage, first of all, Karzai to be, in a sense, the father of his nation in the sense of passing the reins of power to someone else. And for all of his mixed accomplishments and his downsides and weaknesses so far, if Karzai could do that successfully and be seen as encouraging that process along, rather than holding on to power until the last second while his cronies encourage him to suspend the Constitution and stay for a third or fourth term, if he could do that, I think it would really reduce the prospects of civil war in Afghanistan and therefore reduce the prospects of al-Qaeda getting a sanctuary there in the future. So keep your eye attuned to Afghan politics. They're becoming a little more interesting and important. Over to James.
Thank you guys for doing this. When I was looking at my own writing last year, right, when he was killed, it was quoting a lot of people that the hope was that because he was the visionary, he was the guy who sketched the narrative that inflamed the passions of the jihadi world and made it from just a terrorist conglomerate into a really a movement, that without that visionary, it would lose that sort of fervor, it would lose that cohesiveness, and become, again, another fractured group of more manageable terrorist groups. I'm curious whether, and I guess recruitment is maybe a metric by which you watch this, but have we seen a degradation of the vision, the movement that he was sort of masterfully sort of gave a coherent narrative to, and what are those metrics? Is it to look at recruitment? Is it to look at how many franchises have sprung up? Give me your sense of whether we've seen an improvement there that a lot of people were hopeful last year.
I'd like to ask you to both speak. You want to start this one?
Sure. When I look at bin Laden's accomplishment, one of his great accomplishments is institutionalization. You know, if you look at the records of al-Qaeda, you know, what strikes you is you could be looking at the records of, you know, a typically run government bureaucracy, right? There are questions of expenses. There are questions of leave time. There's, you know, questions of, is this guy getting the right pay? And all that is, you know, we look at, we find signs of squabbling and problems, but it shows that it's not simply a charismatic figure unifying people for the short term, that he really saw building an organization as part of what he wanted to do. And he did. So I personally think he expected to be martyred, as he was put it, several decades ago. And so had really thought about, what do I want to leave behind? And as such, put in an organization. And Zawahiri has benefited from this. And Zawahiri certainly is not the charismatic figure bin Laden was, but is an organizer. And so I think you'll see the continued organization. But the next question is, how long can an organization exist simply by, you know, organizational fortitude? And so I look at three things, and they're all things that, from the outside, are very hard to judge. One, as you said, it is recruitment. So both the scale of recruitment and where is it? Is it primarily local? Is it going to affiliates? Or is it lots of people are still eager to go to Pakistan for training by the Al-Qaeda core to do its bidding? Another is fundraising. Where is money going? You know, money is often a barometer of popularity. And the last is command and control. You know, are we seeing affiliate groups, are we seeing local individuals doing attacks that largely follow a game plan that Zawahiri is articulating? And that's always hard because people like me, when we don't know, we try to find a pattern, right? We try to say, this attack happened, it happened at this place and this time for this reason. And often we'll find out years later that it was much more opportunistic, much more random than the pattern seemed to suggest. But over time, you often can get a sense of whether attacks seem to be random or not. An example to me is a fair number of the attacks of a group like Boko Haram in Nigeria are sectarian. They're going after Christian sites in Nigeria. Often they're going after Muslims who are not sufficiently Islamic in their eyes. That's not part of the Zawahiri game plan. That's not what he pushes. And so a question to me, well, will he be able to take groups like that, that have a fervor from the sectarian issues, and shift them more towards the agenda that it has pushed?
I think I in violent agreement with Dan on all of those points, so I'll just make two very brief comments. Al-Qaeda has never seen itself as a mass-based movement. It doesn't believe that it's going to succeed by large crowds of mobilized supporters. It sees itself as a vanguard movement. Ayman Zawahiri's most important book on Al-Qaeda is called Knights Under the Prophet's Banner. And the imagery of knights is supposed to mean a small group of brave warriors who go out there and set the stage, and then events will follow in their wake. You may not like that imagery, but that's their imagery of themselves. Small is beautiful, I would argue, is one of Al-Qaeda's operational principles. And in that context, you don't have to be charismatic. This is not a popularity contest. They're not trying to get people to vote for them. They're trying to get a small, tiny minority of people to go out and commit mass murder and suicide. And so far, I don't see any reduction in that, and I don't expect to see that. Second point I would make, it's a year after. There's no sign of any dissent in Al-Qaeda with Ayman Zawahiri. There's no new poll developing, which is the not Ayman Zawahiri poll. All the franchises have loyally pled allegiance to him. New franchises, like Somalia, are pledging loyalty to him. A new group in the Sinai, whether it's Al-Qaeda or not, has pledged loyalty to him. He's unchallenged right now as the head of Al-Qaeda.
Yes, sir. And then we'll work back again. I'll come up here, too.
Hi, Daniel Morrow, CTR Science, Johns Hopkins. The question is if you can elaborate a bit on the Syrian situation, because I saw that Tunisian fighters were found in Syria, Libyan fighters were found in Syria, and we heard that maybe some action from Al-Qaeda was behind the bombings in Damascus and so on.
Syria certainly has attracted the attention of not only the United States and the Arab world, but also the broader Al-Qaeda jihadist community. And there are a number of figures who have very deep and old ties to this. The Syrian government was complicit in individuals going through Syria, being recruited in Syria, and going into Iraq. So this community knows Syria well from the old days. And Zawahiri has urged people to go and fight. So it's certainly there. This is something that I have a hard time, to be honest, getting great data on. So there are lots of reports. And there are incentives, especially for the regime. The regime's narrative is to say, we're fighting terrorists, and we should give no concession or quarter to these guys because they're a bunch of terrorists. So the regime has an incentive to play up every individual example, and frankly, given this regime, to make up a few, to add fuel to it. That doesn't mean it's not true, though, that individuals are going. And so certainly I think there are credible reports of some people being there, but I haven't seen credible reports that they've had a sizable impact on any of the fighting in any of the places. But the honest answer is I don't know.
As Dan said, the data here is abysmal. But one piece of data I would point you to is some of the spokesmen for the opposition, not the ones who go to the conferences in Geneva and Europe, but who speak on behalf of the opposition in Saudi Arabia or in Qatar, are from the milieu of a Salafist. They see this as not a revolution against dictatorship, per se. They see this as a revolution against a Shia, Alawi, Iranian-imposed regime, which is why the Saudis allow them to say these kinds of things, because it's music to the Saudi ears as well, especially in light of Bahrain. If those spokesmen are in any way reflective of part of the movement inside Syria, and I suspect they will be more reflective if the violence goes on, you're seeing a polarization. And as Dan said earlier, Al-Qaeda thrives on polarized, factionalized, failing states. That's where it has always found its niche. And Syria, to me, right now, is case number one for something like that happening.
One question here in the front row, and then we'll work back, as I said.
Trudy Rubin, Philadelphia Inquirer. Bruce, I wanted to follow up on what you were saying about the network of terrorist groups inside Pakistan. As the United States pulls out combat troops, do you really think a Biden-esque approach is going to be able to cope with that nexus of terror groups? And on the one hand, if there's a political solution where our Taliban basically control the south and the east, would that allow that Pakistani nexus to have its own safe haven and therefore increase the danger inside Pakistan? If there is no political settlement, would that also allow them to flourish? So are we focused on the wrong threat? Because after all, as you've pointed out so many times, that is the country where there's terrorists and nukes.
Very good questions, Trudy, and very hard questions to answer. The Biden plan only applies, because I understood the vice president explain what is alleged to be his plan, only applies to the question of troop levels and mission in Afghanistan. The much more serious long-term threat, which I sound like a broken record here, the syndicate of terrorism, the network of terrorism in Pakistan, is not susceptible to an American military solution. The drones, commando operations can put pressure on parts of it, but that's not going to resolve it. The only way in the end that this cancer in Pakistan is going to go away is change in Pakistan. And that's easy to say and extraordinarily difficult to do. This administration embarked upon a policy of engagement with Pakistan, which I think was the right thing, to see if it could encourage it. 3 years on, not much sign of progress on that front. That's why I have argued that we should now transition to continued engagement, but with a little bit more sharp elbows at the same time. And Mike and I have a piece on this coming out very soon that lays out what that strategy would be like. The syndicate, if you get a genuine political process in Afghanistan that reconciles the Pashtun community to a peaceful role in a new government that respects the Bonn Agreement, that respects certain fundamental human rights, at the top of which I would say women's rights, I think that that does help to stabilize one side of the Afghan-Pakistan border. That would be good for Pakistan in the long term, but it doesn't solve Pakistan's problems. Pakistan's problems can really only be solved by Pakistanis.
I'm going to say one quick word to Trudy, if I could, which is that, as we all know, looking ahead down the road and anticipating where Afghanistan policy could go, there's been discussion that we are going to recommend to Afghans, who will ultimately make many of the decisions, the size of their army and police should decline by about a third in the coming years. When you press the administration on this and you say, how can you commit to that when you don't know how strong the insurgency will be, they say, well, okay, fair enough. We don't know what year it'll begin, 2014, 2015, 2016. Actually, they usually say 2015 or 2016 or 2017, but it still seems pretty soon. And I wonder why they're so confident. And I wonder, frankly, why in a policy we can't anticipate this president cannot currently, with this Congress, appropriate funds for those years. But nonetheless, we're sort of making a big deal out of the difference between $15 billion a year and $16 billion a year as our contribution to the effort, because we're going to still spend $10 to $15 billion a year on military operations of our own. We're going to spend $3 to $5 billion a year on aid for their security forces and for their development. So it's sort of $3 to $5 a year versus $4 to $6 billion a year, which doesn't seem that important if mission success or failure is on the line. And yet everybody's in a hurry to bring the Afghan security forces down from their 350,000 goal that we're soon to reach to 230,000 within short order, even as almost all the NATO troops leave as well. To me, this is one of the most problematic rumblings we hear from the administration, and I hope the NATO summit in Chicago is very careful about this, because we are not yet in a position to recommend this. When you ask military leaders why they go along with it, they often say, well, political godfathers are telling us we have to, and political reality at home requires it. But that's not a compelling argument if it's a difference between $15 billion a year and $16 billion a year, and the consequences could be mission success or mission failure. The Afghan security forces may have to stay at 350,000, in my judgment, for 10 more years. And if that's the price, that's what we have to do to help them succeed, even after we've drawn down, then I think we have to consider doing it. On the third row here, and then thereafter.
Hi, Matt Schofield, McClatchy Newspapers. I was wondering, when we look at AQ Central, the mothership, are they looking to be operational today? Are they looking to be more inspirational? When we look at the affiliates, how interconnected, how deeply connected are the affiliates? We see Boko Haram fighters training with Shabab. We see AQIM passing Libyan weapons out as party favors, it seems. How deeply connected are these things, and is that really the strategy now? AQ Central is the inspirational motivation, and they're looking for the affiliates to carry operations out.
I'll probably ask both of you to speak to this. You want to start?
I'll start with the Al-Qaeda Al-Oum's aspirations. I think they're both. I don't think they see this as either or. I think they see this as both. Zawahiri has been a master propagandist for Al-Qaeda for years. He put out far more audio and video messages than Osama bin Laden ever did. He did the functional equivalent of a terrorist call-in show a couple of years ago, which went on for 3 or 4 hours. And you had to be a really hardcore Al-Qaeda junkie to read the entire thing. He sees the inspirational role very much. He's not always that good at it. Some of his tapes right after the Egyptian Revolution were pathetic. He was talking more about Napoleon Bonaparte as a closet Zionist than what was going on in Tahrir Square. But he regained his form after a while, and I think he definitely sees it in the inspirational role. But Ayman Zawahiri is a trained and practiced terrorist. This guy has carried out terrorist attacks his whole life. And I think he also understands that in the end, if you're going to be the terrorist leader, the mastermind of a terrorist organization, there's one thing you've got to ultimately do, terror. You can't just talk about it. You've got to produce something. Otherwise, you begin to look like a talking shop. So I think from his perspective, he wants to do both, and he will look for an operational activity that Al-Qaeda core can claim credit for, or he'll be happy to claim credit for attack by an affiliate. After all, When Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab carried out his attack in the United States, it was Osama bin Laden who claimed credit for it just a few days later.
Dan.
One thing we've seen since 9/11 is a lot of the attacks that we thought were local, that we thought were, you know, bottom-up, actually had a significant al-Qaeda core connection. And this is, you know, we've seen rises and falls in terms of exact command and control, but al-Qaeda has always pushed multiple levels of operation, right? It's had direct top-down plots. It's had ones that it's provided seed money for. It's done training of individuals in the hopes that they would go off and do al-Qaeda-like things. And it's worked with local groups. And with the local groups, it's always tried to push them in an al-Qaeda direction, but it's been surprisingly tolerant of a fairly wide range. And so with the al-Qaeda affiliates, we see al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb that, yes, has taken on more Western, more international targets, but I don't think to the extent that the al-Qaeda core hoped for when this discussion began several years ago of affiliation. We see the Shabab moving in a more regional direction, taking on more anti-Western, anti-U.S. rhetoric. But I would say the closest is al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, where we saw, you know, tremendous coordination. We saw tremendous closeness in terms of, you know, again, Bruce mentioned the plane bombings. Those could have been al-Qaeda core operations, right? Had the intelligence community found evidence that they were al-Qaeda core, everyone would have nodded. So what we've seen is, you know, some affiliates moving a little bit in the al-Qaeda direction, some moving a lot. And so I think you really have to go affiliate by affiliate.
Let's work back. Gentleman right there. Yes, please.
My name is Munawar Lagari. I'm with Sindhi American Political Action Committee. I think I have one comment and question, too. Al-Qaeda is one thing, but there are many organizations in Pakistan like Jamaatul Dawa, Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, and recently 42 organizations with the name of Defy Pakistan, and also a lot of the terrorist organization, BAIN organization became the part of that, and even the former inter-service intelligence, Hamid Gul, that is also one reaction after the 1 year completed, and they are working over the grassroots level. And I don't see any U.S. policy to counter them. How is they going to counter them? Their modus operandi is they reach those places where they are vulnerable, crushed, like in Sindh after the flood. They open more than 300 model homes. In Balochistan, they are very active. Madrasas, homes, hospitals, schools. And I haven't seen that, like Mr. Bruce said, that $25 billion, where the American taxpayer money went. And their other modus operandi is jihad. We call them terrorists, but they call jihad. So one thing is their action is jihad. Their uniting force is called Ummah, and anti-America, anti-India, anti-Israel, anti-Zionist movement. And I didn't see anything they have are very grassroots level they are getting organized. And Pakistani military and Pakistani government, I have seen that they are keeping their eye blind. And I don't know how is going to we counter them like Hamas and in Pakistan like Jamaatul Dawa, Jamaat-e-Islami, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, Lashkar-e-Tayyiba. You can name it.
Thank you. Bruce.
Oh, you point to a very important phenomenon. It's what I refer to as the syndicate, but you've also used the name of this new organization, Defense Council of Pakistan, or Council for the Defense of Pakistan, which is in effect headed by Hafez Saeed. I don't know whether he's the official president of Defense Committee, but he's the star attraction when they hold these gigantic outside rallies like the one they're planning for tomorrow in Quetta. This is a very disturbing development. And the bottom line of Defense Committee of Pakistan is total opposition to any reconciliation with the United States, to any cooperation with the United States. And they mean to hold the Pakistani parliament and the Zardari government to its statement that all drone operations will cease. That's why I think U.S.-Pakistani relations are in a very difficult situation, because I think when that next drone operation has, or maybe the third or fourth next drone operation happens, the Defense Committee of Pakistan is going to demand that the government of Pakistan do something about it, and the Zardari government's going to find itself in a very, very difficult place. Up until now, we've all lived in the world that Pakistan secretly approves drone operations, and in fact, the Zardari government did secretly approve them for a long time. But the veils and the fog is come off Pakistan. That's what happened in 2011. All the fog dissipated about the true nature of the U.S.-Pakistani relationship, epitomized in the president's decision not to tell the Pakistanis where Osama bin Laden was. And it's very hard to put the fog and the veils back on the dancer when it's already happened. In the end, Pakistan's going to have to figure out what kind of a country it wants to be. Does it want to be a victim and a patron state sponsor of terrorism? Or does it want to be a more modern, progressive country as it was originally envisioned back in 1947? It's moved in the wrong direction for a long time. The Zardari government, I just want to make one more point about the Zardari government. As feckless as it often is, the Zardari government is probably more oriented towards the kind of outcome that we would like to see, a progressive, entrepreneurial-based government that tries to make peace with its neighbors than any other conceivable government that I can see on the Pakistani horizon. After all, Zardari has gone to India now in a pretty bold move. I'm skeptical that it will get very far. I think the dark forces in Pakistan are already preparing. Your earlier question, why haven't we seen Lashkar-e-Taiba act until now? Well, for 3 years, it didn't need to. India-Pakistan relations were completely stalemated. If Indian-Pakistani relations now start to move towards rapprochement, look for Lashkar-e-Taiba and all the other groups that you mentioned to react and to try to sabotage that. That's not a reason not to move towards reconciliation, but it's a recognition that it's going to be very, very hard to do. Last point about the Zardari government. Odds are now looking pretty good that President Zardari will be the first elected Pakistani head of state to actually serve a full term in office in the history of the Pakistani state. That may not seem like a big accomplishment to most of us, but that's a huge accomplishment in terms of Pakistan's political history.
Stay in the back for a minute, and then we'll finish up front. Anybody else in the back have a question? Okay, well, there were a few up front, so we'll go to those. Right here, sir.
Al Richmond from the former State Department. As an observer of Afghan-Pakistan affairs, you don't hear much about the division within the Pakistan Army and ISA. You mentioned that together they have remodeled a contain and corral policy. What do we know about differences of views within the Army and ISA that you could help us dealing with Pakistan?
No, I'm going to do, if you don't mind, I'm going to take Gary Mitchell's question, too, and then we'll just wrap up. Remember, did you have one as well? Sir? Okay, so we'll take, if you don't mind taking notes, we'll take all three questions and then wrap. Did you see someone else?
There's a lady in the back.
Oh, I'm sorry. I haven't seen your hand. We'll do that, too. Just everybody's got their pens out, so go ahead. We're going to take all four.
I'm Gary Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And the question that Mike asked some time ago about where are we as compared to a year ago and 5 years ago and 10 years ago leads me to look the other direction and wonder where we will be on this set of questions or issues 5 years from now and 10 years from now and 20 years from now. And I recognize that that's sort of an impossible sort of scenario planning. So I want to put the question this way. In addition to all that you've talked about today and the subjects that you covered today, the three of you represent a lot of knowledge of, about political history. And I'm interested to know whether in your thinking about the present moment with Islamic Jihad, if you see other historical parallels, movements that either faded away, were destroyed, or succeeded, that help you think about where this might be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and 25 years from now.
Great. Ma'am, in the middle there. Yes, please.
Thank you. Chantal Carter from the Osgoode Center for International Studies. My question is regarding counterterrorism. What are a few obstacles concerning international intelligence and law enforcement cooperation, specifically in Somalia and Yemen? And how has the U.S. improved cooperation, given that Somalia is a transit point to Yemen? And do you feel finally that Al-Qaeda is weakening in the Arabian Peninsula?
And finally, because I know these two are up to it, we'll take a fourth question, and then maybe they can divvy up how they respond to wrap.
Excuse me. I'm Jim Byrne. I'm the Washington correspondent for Minority Business Entrepreneur magazine. Former National Security Council staffer made a comment at a session at Carnegie about a month ago. He said that at long last, after being diverted with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that they're seriously at work within the administration, presumably on the National Security Council, developing scenarios for the total collapse of Pakistan. And he didn't have anything to say about what those scenarios might be. I'm, especially you, Bruce, I wonder what you would think would be possible scenarios and who would get the nukes.
So two Pakistan questions, one Yemen-Somalia question, and then one broad historical perspective question.
Okay. Sure. The historical one, analog, is an exceptionally difficult one. People have fallen back on a Cold War analogy and talking about the strength of communism as an ideology. I actually tend to fall back, if you want to look at historical metaphors, one of interest to me is actually anarchism, which was an exceptionally strong and powerful movement in much of the West. Really in the kind of, 1880 to 1935, 1939 period, depending on which country you're talking about. And, of course, the big spate of international terrorism where prime ministers and presidents are dying. You see it as a strong social force and militia force in countries like Spain during the Spanish Civil War. But a difference is anarchism never takes over a country. And what made, to me, communism such a danger was communists ran countries, and they were able to mobilize the power of a country. And if you look at Al-Qaeda, one of the things Zawahiri has consistently emphasized is that control of territory, control of government is exceptionally important. I get very frustrated with talk of virtual jihad or you don't need a base. It's certainly not how Zawahiri and bin Laden saw the situation. So the question then becomes, why do ideologies, if you will, rise or fall? And, there are answers, of course, depending on the historical ideology. Often they fall because they fail in practice, right? I mean, why did communism become discredited? Because it was an utter disaster for anyone who had the horror of being a subject of a communist government. But anarchism, I think, over time lost its romance, right? And other things simply rose in its place. And to me, that's the long-term hope, is not that this ideology is completely gone, but that there are other ones, ideally more positive ones, that take its place. But I don't have a neat replacement for you. Somalia, Yemen. Cooperation, for the most part, is pretty bad. But that's because government is either lacking or poor in these areas. In Yemen, perhaps ironically, actually, we've seen cooperation get better in the last year, which is a bit of a surprise, considering the demise, if you will, of the Saleh regime. But we've seen cooperation in a number of fronts get better. But how this will affect the strength of groups there is, to me, we're at a key moment in Yemen right now because we're seeing two different things. We're seeing on the ground the spread of the jihadist movement taking over territory. And that has the potential to transform the nature of the struggle in Yemen. Conversely, the United States is trying to replicate aspects of the drone campaign in Pakistan and Yemen. So there was a story in the newspaper this morning about the approval of signature strikes. And so that is, from a U.S. point of view, suggests that we are seeing Al-Qaeda, the Arabian Peninsula, analogously to how we're seeing the Al-Qaeda core. And that is a big shift. That's not simply part of it. It's not simply a few operatives, a few cells we're going after. So it's going to be a vastly different campaign. So I think that, in contrast to much of the other parts of this movement, this is going to be a real turning point in the next 12 months.
Bruce.
I was right to ask him to go first because I didn't have a clue how to answer Gary's question, and he had a great answer. So I'll just stick to the Pakistan questions. The Pakistani military is not a monolith. We don't have any reason to believe that all Pakistani officers think in a certain direction or another. But on the other hand, we don't have a lot of data either. The best data you can develop is from formers, ex-officers, who then go on into careers as talking heads or writers on Pakistani television. And there I think you see a pretty big spectrum. What disturbs me is that there's a very large sector of these formers in the talking heads camp who are outright jihadists and apologists for terrorists. Hamid Ghul was mentioned earlier, a perfect example. I think there's solid reason to believe that Hamid Ghul is not just an apologist for terror, he's actually involved in supporting the Afghan Taliban and other groups as well. And I wouldn't be surprised to find out that he has connections with even more dangerous groups than that. So if you look at the spectrum of formers, you have a pretty broad spectrum, but a pretty solid component at the extremely dangerous end of the spectrum, which gets to the question of the collapse of Pakistan. I don't anticipate Pakistan dissolving as a state. This is an entity that now has a large army, police forces. It's a police state in many ways, although a very complicated police state. There are separatist movements, but it's unlikely that they are going to be able to separate from the center as East Pakistan separated and became Bangladesh. I think the more dangerous scenario is that you would have another military coup in Pakistan in the course of the next decade, and this new military dictator is the 21st century reincarnation of Zia-ul-Haq. That is to say, a committed jihadist who believes in the jihad, who is not a giving it lip service, but who really believes in it. Do those people exist in the Pakistani army today? Well, if your formers are any indication, you can bet they are. And Zia-ul-Haq started a process of Islamicization of the Pakistani military back in the 1980s, which means that the people that he recruited into the officer corps are just on the cusp now of running the officer corps of Pakistan. And by and large, the information the United States has on many of these people is extraordinarily thin. It's from the standpoint of someone who studies leadership behavior, you couldn't determine leadership behavior on the basis of what we know about many of these generals. That's the scenario that worries me the most, and this is the point at which I unabashedly, of course, push my own book, and I have a chapter on it entitled Thinking of the Unthinkable in Pakistan.
I'm going to say one last word as we finish, because just partly for humor value, I think it's always nice to finish with some good news and look to Iraq for the good news. And you may find that not only funny, but surprising why I would say that, because obviously Iraq's not doing great in its political terms. But what I would say, and this builds a little bit on Gary's question and Dan's answer, is that in Iraq there are a lot of challenges, but al-Qaeda is not going to win the war, in my judgment. And these two may disagree if they wish, but obviously there still are attacks in Iraq. And it still creates apprehension, limits foreign investment, and so forth. But if Iraq fails, it's going to fail because of high-level politics among people who most clearly are not members of al-Qaeda and have more in the way of probably personal agendas than terrorist agendas or even sectarian agendas at this point. The latter are part of how they define themselves. But Maliki's after power more than he's after Shia dominance, per se, or more than he's interested in anything having to do with al-Qaeda. So it's been ugly. It's been messy for us, for them. Al-Qaeda has done horrible things within Iraq. But even if Iraq fails, it won't be because al-Qaeda won. It will be because Iraqis had a chance after all these years, and hopefully they will make good use of it, even if we can't yet know that's the fact. And violence levels today in Iraq are not where they should be, but they're still lower than they were in previous years. And so That may not really amount to huge great news or cause for celebration, but in this kind of a conversation, it may be at least a reasonably positive way to finish. So thank you for coming. Please join me in thanking Easter.